Sandro, so tell me, must be a great day for you today.
Yeah, it was perfect, but we just have to be calm and concentrated, and then everything will be good.
Okay, thanks. Congratulations.
Thanks.
The yellow flag has been shown. The red flag is being taken away. The lights will go to red.
Away they go. Good start from Danny Pedrosa. Whenever he never says that. Here we go. Valentino Rossi had a good start as well.
Hello and welcome to Motopod, the internet radio show all about motorcycle road racing. This is episode 339 for Wednesday, 3rd of October, 2012. I'm Len Padilla in Pamplona, Spain, and with me is Martin Darlington in the north of Wales.
I certainly am, and we've got some pretty interesting stuff to talk about.
I hope so.
But before we start, I've got two noises this week. This is the first one. So that is a kind of Guinness.
I don't know if I have anything to match that. How about, you can't hear me drinking a bottle of water, can you?
Not really.
God, that's sad.
Yeah, it's just the one for me tonight because I'm working tomorrow.
All right. 8 hours bottle to throttle.
Yeah, exactly. 10 hours is our rule.
Okay, even
really
better.
Strict. But and the other noise I've got is I'm going to have to try and impersonate a medical condition. It's more an emotional condition.
It sounds terrible.
That was meant to be the sound of someone choking. Actually, that was the sound of quite a lot of people choking, namely the US Ryder golf team. Sorry, that was always going to come in there. Come on, bring it to me.
Yeah, if I liked golf or if I were a nationalist, I'd jump all over that, Martin, but I'm neither. Yeah.
No, I'm not into golf particularly. I just enjoy ragging people. John Hart, I await your riposte. We have got Len. Of course, you were at Aragon this weekend.
I was. We had a great weekend. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, and thank goodness we had a dry Sunday. I mean, what's going on? It's in the middle of a desert, and it rained Friday and Saturday.
It was a bit of a mess, but you know, it's not unheard of. We're pretty far north in Spain, and this far into the fall in October, you know, it's not guaranteed weather, not at all.
No. And you did manage to pin down some riders. We've got various interviews coming up. Scott Redding, a very brief chat you got with Sandro Cortez and Gino Rea, and a longtime friend of the show and character, Ian Wheeler, who was tweeting this weekend that he won't be in the pit lane next year. He said it was always only ever a one-year deal, but he's been there before and gone away and come back, so fingers crossed, because I do enjoy Nick Harris, Gavin Emmett, and Ian's three-way banter, and their knowledge is, you know, pretty impressive.
Yeah, Ian's always fun to listen to. He's funny. He's one of these guys that seems to, he goes through life without a safety net. All his jobs are one-year jobs, and he always seems to land on his feet.
Yeah, he's got his fingers in a lot of different pies,
yeah,
I think.
Does.
So don't want to get those burnt. And we also need to give a massive shout out to Randy Cobb, who is a super freaking cool friend of the show this week because he's donated. So, Randy, thank you very much indeed. Keeps the wheels turning and gives us the opportunity to have guys like Len going off to the races. Obviously, unless Bill Gates appears in the Donator of the Week, we're unlikely to be covering any of the next couple of races. Sepang in Japan, but we may have someone at PI, which would be good. Listener feedback. We had Mick Lumley sent in. Do you remember, Len, was it last week or the week before, we were talking about the Coxisms? I think it was 2 weeks ago, so it was me and Jim, I think, and Charlie Cox saying someone's not HP.
Yeah, you know, I don't think I know any of the Coxisms since I never watched the races on BBC.
Oh, you've been spared them. Well, this weekend, I decided not to go with BBC. I was at work, so I managed to I watched it online at MotoGP.com, having coughed up for the massive subscription earlier in the year. So I had Gavin Emmett and Nick Harris, which is far better. They're, you know, every bit as good as Julian Ryder and Toby Moody. But I was spared the Coxisms. They're ridiculous. But don't start me on that, because we've got a lot to get through in the show. But this phrase, not HP, I am not HP. Mick Lumley, well remembered, Mick. He remembers the phrase coming from, and he's put a YouTube link, which we'll put into the show notes. And it was the boxer Frank Bruno in an advert for HP sauce, which is brown sauce. I don't do brown sauce. It's the devil's vomit as far as I'm concerned. But and it was Frank Bruno, me giving a plate of food and sitting there going, I am not HP. And then someone passed him a jar of HP sauce, a bottle of HP sauce. He puts it on and goes, now I'm HP. So well remembered, Mick.
That's a wonderful literary reference. Well done for Charlie Cox.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. To an advert from the 80s. Sam Dixon emailed and said, hey, guys, have you got any Isle of Man TT stickers still lying around? I'd love to buy one if you do. So, Jim, you were the man with the Isle of Man TT stickers. Sam wants to buy some. I believe we were planning to retail them at $500 a pop, in which case, if you want half a dozen, we will be going to Japan. But do you want to just run through Sam's main point, Len, on the Spec ECU?
Yeah, well, he's wondering about, what's really going to happen with the Spec ECU. So what he says is, I think if Ezpeleta wants to institute a Spec ECU, he should drop back the Spec tire rule. Not sure if that's going to happen. Obviously, theoretical, as we know that Bridgestone is contracted for the next 3 years. I believe opening the tires back up would allow some room for engineering development, given that the Spec ECU will kill its fair share of development possibilities. I think we can all agree that having a single tire has limited chassis development, etc., unless it's a manufacturer that truly wanted the Spec tire.
Yeah, I mean,
might be apples and oranges there.
Yeah, my biggest concern over the Spec ECU, and this was my initial reaction to Sam, we've got a bit more about this in the news, in the news items we're doing. My concern is the threat of HRC pulling out of MotoGP. Nakamoto said, we're not interested in all CRT. We're not interested in having a Spec ECU forced on them because it kills a lot of their R&D development leeway, at least in terms of manufacturer specificality. That was meant to say, not specifically. Bad England. I learned that as a children. Now, I'd have said that was a bluff. And Jim said, Jim's pretty much said, look, that's typical HRC puffery, which it probably is, and hopefully it is, except for the fact that they're suddenly focusing so much more on World Superbike. And the MSMA have been marginalised to a large degree. Basically, Ezpeleta, is putting down a marker saying, look, we gave you the reins, the deal being you'll fill the grid. You haven't filled the grid, therefore we're going to take the reins back. But I'll hold any discussion on that until we get to the talk about the David Emmett article, which was very interesting. But I would like to point out, Andy Pilbeam finally got his stickers and tweeted, got the stickers. Thanks, Nob. And I thought, that's a bit harsh, mate. until I remember the conversation that we'd had with, I have a Jules saying, you know, look, I forgot. I didn't choose not to send them. I'm a knob, not a wanker. So I absolutely get that. And Andy did put a little smiley face behind it to take the edge off us. Because I first read it, I thought, okay, he's not a very nice guy. But no, I get the joke. And Andy referencing my own comment in our podcast of only 2 weeks ago, and I'd forgotten it already.
You told him what to call you.
I did indeed. Yes. So anyway, I'm chuffed that they arrived, Andy. I'm sorry there wasn't a note in there, but I was sort of in out of my car and I just had an envelope and a sticker, so I lobbed them in and posted them. So some pretty big news breaking. Why don't you take us through the Bridgepoint thing?
Sure, yeah.
Have you seen this?
Oh, yeah. I've been seeing it and, you know, reading all the tweets and thinking a lot about it all day. I guess, you know, the long and the short of it is that, you know, Bridgepoint, the private equity firm that actually, they bought Dorna back in, I think it was 2006, you know, when MotoGP was really in its heyday, and it looked like a fantastic investment for them. And, you know, I don't know the exact date, but I want to say that it was 2 or 3 years ago that they bought Infront. Not specifically to get any World Superbike action, because that's such a small part of it, but more for the, I think they do, you know, they covered a lot of the Winter Olympics. They do a lot of winter sports. and a lot of football as well. So that was, you know, a big thing for Bridgepoint to get into. Now all of a sudden, they've decided to, you know, not fold the series together, but fold the organizations together in some sense. Nobody really knows yet, because all we've got to go from is, you know, the first, the initial press release that says that they're going to build an umbrella organization and put management of the two series under the same organization. But, you know, this is typical of what happens in the merger acquisition world. You know, the first press release that you see is very, very carefully worded to not offend any sensibilities, and then we're going to find out what really happens a bit later.
Yeah, I thought the FIM statement was again, like you say, it's reading between the lines. They welcomed the move and then added, "We shall shortly be holding a meeting of all the stakeholders in order to reposition the two championships, not to confirm the positions of." So to reposition the two championships, look into the technical and operating implications. We will then be able to adapt the regulations to ensure they have a distinct identity in future, which would imply, if anything, moving them slightly further apart or clarifying, maybe. So it may well be, and some quarters reporting that this is what's going to happen, Carmelo Ezpeleta will head up the umbrella organization, which pretty much puts him at the head of both championships.
Yep.
And either puts them in a position to ensure they don't encroach on each other's perceived territory. So you have, you know, World Superbike remains production-based, MotoGP remains prototype-based. And just as importantly, particularly for those of us who try and watch all the racing, the calendars are better coordinated. But then I did think, as you've just kind of intimated, one day, maybe, Toby Moody's long-held belief that there is not the sufficient audience for two flourishing World Motorcycle Championships might be realized in the merging of the two series.
Yeah, it could happen. You know, I think it would be a shame. You know, I've grown up watching both. And, you know, I think there's a place for both. But then, you know, you and I are serious petrol heads. I don't know what casual viewers of the sport would think. They probably wouldn't even notice.
I think there's some novelty to be had from having the BMW S1000R that you can buy out the dealers with an awful lot of added bits, but it looks the same and it's called the same, going up against, you know, a MotoGP bike. But, and one argument that I heard being voiced in a pub recently was they've kind of got a two-tier championship in MotoGP already with CRT. Would it really hurt to add a third? And you think, I don't know. I mean, the hardest thing is we would lose two-thirds of the races we currently get to watch because with World Superbike, you know, running two races a weekend unless they introduce that. The other possibility, I suppose, is you run the series together as in where they go and where they race, but you have one World Superbike race, you have one MotoGP race, and then you have one of the lower classes, which would see Moto2 and World Supersport, one of them disappear. And yeah, I don't know. Anyway,
I was going to say what I really hope happens is that they just clarify things a bit. You know, I would like to see continuing the quote unquote prototype series, the MotoGP series, and maybe to get a clearer separation between the two. You know, maybe you knock World Superbike down a bit. Maybe you make the superbikes a little closer to Superstock. You know, you're only talking a few seconds in lap times if you do that. And
probably
and
not even a few seconds, yeah.
Yeah, get a clearer separation and make it, you know, make it, and in a business sense, you might make the two different products a little more marketable by separating them a bit.
Well, they've done it. I mean, let's look at BSB, and I know a lot of our listeners won't have access to watch BSB, but, you know, for those who haven't, trust me, the racing has been brilliant this season. And they went, last year and the year before, they had Evo class, which was very much more super stock, the spec ECU and the like. And then you had the upper class, if you like, the full superbike class. Well, this year, everyone's on Evo. No one's saying, well, hang on, you know, they haven't broken any lap records, you know, and it's all rubber. It's been bloody brilliant. So it's all relative.
Yeah, the racing has been good. It's been spectacular. You know, it's been really good to watch. I think World Superbike could really, really take a hint from BSB.
But I'd hate to see, well, we'll come on to that in a moment. I was going to say that sort of control applied to MotoGP. But in World Superbike, Liberty Effinbert, as Jules likes to call them, have announced they won't be at Manicor. Brett McCormack and Lorenzo Lanzi, who raced in the last round, Lanzi coming in to replace the sacked Maxime Berger, who joined Sylvain Guintoli and Kuba Smirtz, having been kicked out by the team for, I don't know, doing quite well. So they're without a ride. We don't know what's going to happen in 2013. Supposedly the team have kept hinting, oh, we're talking to Aprilia, we're talking to BMW, we're going to, yeah, we're definitely back next year. Yeah, okay. I mean, that team has had the most bizarre disaster of a season, and yet they've had the most successful in terms of results. It's just...
Yeah, they've had great results. You know, I can't help but think that at the root of this, it's, well, a couple of things. You know, primarily it's money. You know, so their money has probably just dried up. But then it seems like somebody in that organization doesn't work particularly well under stress.
Yeah.
And, you know,
there's a lot of knee-jerk reactions.
Yeah, a lot of wild things happening and a lot of very, very strange press releases.
Oh, I think they have a press release schedule that must be, well, we'll wait till the pubs close at 2 a.m, then we'll write them.
That might be it.
that's a brilliant plan, you know. It's absolutely bizarre. But I suppose in a way, if it does purely, and it's got to come down to finances, and somebody's under a lot of pressure to make the books balance. You know, the most successful rider goes first, Sylvain Guintoli. Well, he is the most successful rider. He was probably the highest profile, and he was probably being paid the most. So, you know, it's probably a case of they are, you know, getting rid of the high earners first. In other World Superbike news, Crescent Suzuki and Jack Valentine have both announced after a 5-year association, Jack Valentine is to leave the organization. Seems to be very amicable. You know, that he said, I'm very sorry, but it's time to go and look forward. And then he added, I look forward to taking them on in the future. The team have said he'll always be a friend, he'll always be welcome here. And Paul Denning is going to take over day-to-day running of the team. Read between the lines, this is just my take on it. Jack Valentine, very, very respected in both BSB and World Superbike paddock, but the team's performance this season have been wildly variable at best, and two undoubtedly very, very talented riders in John Hopkins and Leon Camier haven't really been able to, you know, mix it at the front on any kind of regular basis. John Hopkins has had a terrible season, and yet we know from BSB last year, from his MotoGP wildcards, he's just as capable as ever. So I don't know. I suspect that we might see some changes.
Yeah, yeah. They've certainly not done the business this year. I don't know if it's all down to who was running the team and how it was being run. I think part of it might be they put a lot of hope in the Yoshimura Association that they had, and that doesn't seem to have done them the good that they thought it was going to do. You know, once they got Les Pearson building the engines again, the bike started going again.
Yeah.
But it really makes you wonder, you know, what's going on there. You've got a couple of guys like John and Leon, who are, you know, undoubtedly fast. Look what John did in BSB, and look what Leon's done on the Aprilia in the past, and haven't done much. You know, Leon's been better lately, to be fair. You know, he's come on, but, you know, not what we expected of that team.
Well, he was far enough to the front to try and ram Max Biaggi off the track a couple of times.
Yep.
At Portimao, which, you know, Leon, that's going to get you nothing but kudos with 90% of race fans. And then there was a brilliant article by, and I'll put a link in the show notes, by David Emmett, regarding, it was his Friday roundup from Aragon. And I think David was a bit depressed, possibly by the weather, but he was saying, you know, it's the specter of a spec ECU rearing its head again. And he quoted Camilo Espeleta saying a final decision on the implementation rules was on hold as they waited the outcome of a meeting with the manufacturers in Japan. Said he's very optimistic, but the precise nature of the rules governing the use of such an ECU, which is going to be made by Magnetic Marelli, are still to be explained. And that's if they even know them yet. Now, it seems, well, we know that Magnetic Marelli will be offering a free ECU to any teams that want to take it up. This is MotoGP. In 2013, the expectation is it will be announced as being compulsory for all teams in 2014. Honda and Yamaha have both expressed concern, but David brought up a very good point I've not heard expressed before in a very typically detailed article. He said, does a compulsory ECU, it could be, he's suggesting it can be, here's the box, and the box and the construction is a spec. And it's built by Magnetic Rally, and they're issued to the troops, to the teams. But then, can the teams program the fuel map as they see fit? Now, that gives a lot more leeway for them to incorporate the R&D. And as he pointed out, Yamaha already used Magnetic Rally ECU. So that wouldn't be that much of a sea change for them. Honda, yeah, it would, but they might swallow that. If they are given a fuel map, well, I'm not sure how much that leaves them to be able to, you know, if they're given the program for that circuit, I don't know how much variability that leaves them with.
Yeah, I can't see them ever getting that, specified a map or anything like that. I would imagine that they're going to get spec hardware, definitely.
Yeah.
And possibly the algorithms or the strategies that they use, you know, are they allowed to do traction control based on lean angle, or is it only based on throttle opening, or does it know which corner you're in? I think those are the kinds of things that would be reasonable. You know, this is what I think, that it would be reasonable for them to be limited in. But again, you know, nobody knows. I'm sure that behind the scenes, like all big announcements or like all big impacting changes, you know, the organization running this has a lot of things to juggle. They're trying to get everybody in line. They're trying to get everybody to agree to it before they make the announcement. You know, it would be a disaster if they made an announcement and then somebody had something to say against it. You know, they need unanimous approval once they get it announced. So, you know, by the time we hear the announcement, it'll all be so much theater or a ceremony. And right now is when the hard work is happening. I'm sure that, Ezpeleta or whoever it is are having meetings with Honda, Yamaha, whoever, and just trying to get this all hammered out.
Yeah, I mean, I think the thing we can't afford to do is lose HRC, but they probably know that, so they're going to play hardball, and then it's, you know, yeah.
Yeah, it'd be a shame to lose them.
David's conclusion, well, I think it would be the end of MotoGP as we know it to lose them. I'm not a huge fan of HRC and the way they do things, but they... I think without them, you're pretty much down to Yamaha and Ducati, and that's not a championship.
No, it isn't. Yeah, I asked David where all the doom and gloom was when I saw him at the weekend, and he said that maybe it was just bad weather and not having had a lot of sleep. So I'm hoping that's what it was.
Yeah. But there is some doom and gloom around. Moto2, Claudio Corti's been dropped for the rest of the season by his team, and they're bringing in Tony Elias. How anyone thinks that's good, but well, obviously this isn't down to results, because that ain't going to make anything better. Sorry, Tony, but it's obviously down to money. Then Mattia Pessini has been dropped by Speedmaster, and he was tweeting furiously. I did run Google Translate on the Italian, but it didn't make a whole lot of sense.
No,
other than the fact that he's very disappointed.
He's unhappy.
And he mentioned vultures. But they brought in Robbie Rolfo. Now, he's a lovely fellow, Robbie Rolfo. I actually met him at briefly in the BSB paddock some years ago. And he's very experienced. And, you know, if he turns up on your track day, he is going to make everyone in the fast group look like novices, look like clowns. But he ain't going to do any better than Mattia Pessini, I can't imagine. He'll turn some laps. I don't know if he brings a personal sponsor. I don't know. And in Moto3, Jasper Wehme has been kicked out of the FGR team in favor of Josep Rodriguez. And the concern, I think, is this has to be financial.
I think so. I mean, we're getting toward the end of the year. You know, we know that some of these teams run on, you know, what for us would be a lot of money, but, you know, shoestring budgets at this level.
Yeah.
And they're probably just to the point where, you know, I think it's really unfortunate. I think that there's some, you know, some kids that should probably still be racing that aren't going to be. But at the end of the day, would you rather see the teams, you know, continue to line up and race with another rider or fold and go home? You know, it's the lesser of two evils, but I'd rather see them, you know, pick another rider that brings some money and go to the races.
What concerns me is far from turning around in this worldwide recession, the effect, if you use motorcycle racing as your example, it seems to be getting worse. Because I can't remember this many people getting hoofed this late in the season in the past. You know, for results, yes, but this doesn't seem to be results based.
Doesn't seem like it, no.
And also, it is looking increasingly likely that, contrary to Jim's prediction that we wouldn't see him again until PI, Casey Stoner will return in Japan, at least to test on the Friday and see how fit he is. Johnny Ray let slip at Aragon that that's probably his last race for this season in MotoGP. And sources, this is Superbike Planet sources, so they're Dean's sources.
Staff.
They've sources have said that Casey's supposedly expressed a desire to race, get at least two races under his belt before the PI swan song. But Danny Pedrosa came out with a really impressive statement, and someone was saying to him, you know, if Casey comes back, you know, would you expect him to help you win the title? And he said, no, I'd never ask him for help, as in team orders. He said, the champion should be the fastest rider over a season. He said, we're both winners, so he'll want to win. And I thought, is that magnanimous, or is he just being really perceptive and he knows that no one's got any hold over Casey? He's not going to want for money. If he did, he wouldn't be retiring. So I don't think any request would hold any water with him whatsoever. He is not going to come back and give up points to anybody, I don't think. He may, if Danny gets out front and Casey, you know, is worried that Jorge's going to get past him and Casey's holding second, he may try and slow him down and block him to give Danny a bit of a break to get away. But I think he'd only do that if he was convinced he couldn't catch Danny.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, at the end of the day, they're racers. I hope that if Casey can win, he wins. You know, I hope that everybody's doing the best they can. Like you said, maybe he could slow Jorge down a little bit if he gets into second. But even then, if Danny wins a bunch of times and Jorge finishes third a bunch of times, I don't think it matters. I think that, you know, the numbers will still stack up the way they do.
If Danny wins all four remaining races, Jorge can come third three times and he has only got to come second once and he's still champion. But as we've seen, you know, the unexpected can happen.
Definitely. We could still see some, you know, somebody fall down and throw it all wide open again.
And we had some examples of completely out off the wall stuff in some of the races this weekend. But before we get started on Moto3, Moto2, MotoGP, loads of us have seen Aragon on the telly. Very few of us have been there. You've not only been there this weekend, you've done track days there, I believe.
Yeah. It's not too far from where I live. It's only about 3 hours away. So it's it's my closest favorite track. I've got another track 30 minutes away, but I consider Aragon my home track because it's the one that I like the most that's closest. So yeah.
So what's your impressions from riding it?
I think it's absolutely fantastic. It's got this this first half of the track before you get to the downhill chicane. It's all fairly steep uphill and it's all linked together turns. You're constantly going back and forth, left and right. Very, very technical because the corners aren't terribly blind, but the line isn't terribly obvious between some of them. You know, as you get when you get linked turns, sometimes you have to sacrifice a little in one to get a good run at the next one. So it's great. And then once you get around the chicane, everything is just fast, fast, fast. You've got this turn 10 and turn 11 section that are incredibly fast, especially 11, before you get to what I hear people refer to as the bus stop. So, you know, turns 12 to 15. And then you've got that monster downhill straight, which is just, you know, there's just no other way to put it. You know, even a slow bike or relatively slow bike like mine is doing 280 at the end of that before I get so scared that I have to put the brakes on.
Yeah. So when you say as slow as yours, what do you ride?
Ducati 1198. So it's not slow. I'm the slow one.
I was going to say that doesn't sound particularly slow.
No, it goes pretty well, but I do my best to slow it down.
Yeah. Super stuff. And of course, we again had one of those crazy weekends where it just bloody rained. Then it was part rain, part dry. You know, it's again, this has brought up the debate of do we have intermediates? And apparently one of the things that the riders were like, oh, not really, because it's so rare you get to use them until this season. Although one opinion I heard was the riders saying, no, we don't need intermediates. We just need more wets. Because the problem is when you get these drying conditions, you can destroy a set. And I think they only get four sets of wets for a whole weekend. They said, well, they can do that. You can do two of those per session.
Yeah. I mean, that's plenty if it stays wet. But as soon as the dry line forms, those things are gone, before they can even come in to get some more.
Yeah, exactly. So, no, I think that's probably a reasonably good argument not to go back to to intermediates, because again, how do you? I mean, the old MotoGP intermediates was your tire technician just cut a few grooves into a slick,
cutting some slicks,
and it was how well he did it, and if it was on the wetter side of intermediate, he could put a couple more in, and if he, it's a heck of a skill, but what a variable to introduce. So they'd have to produce a standard one. I mean, the sort of tread you see on some of the road tires now would probably suffice, but
some of the road tires, it wouldn't even be enough.
No, absolutely. Really interesting conversation. I'm just hoping it's not that important next year because we end up with a bit of a dry year. It's been bizarre. I can't remember a season this wet.
Yeah, and not just wet, like you said, with these conditions where it's not wet, it's not dry, throw into the mix people being worried about their engine counts and things like that, and you've got, many, many riders just sitting in the box waiting for it to either dump or dry out. I often feel really bad, I understand why they do it, but you feel really bad for the fans that have either gone to the track or the people watching television that, would like to see something.
Yeah, and it's a very good point actually made by one of the articles I was reading about the tires, and they were saying, the promoters have to try and encourage people to go out because you've got fans who've turned up at the stadium, you've got at the racetrack, you've got people watching on television, and there's only so much ad libbing that Toby Moody and Julian Ryder can do. They do it very well, but you need a little bit more than that, yeah. And they want to see people going round. Yeah. So we did have some really interesting qualifying conditions. Jonas Folgo, who was good all weekend, he got pole position with Luis Salom and Sandro Cortese making up row one. Romano Fenati, Danny Kent and Maverick Vinales were row two. So Vinales having a better time in the damp conditions. Kai Rudin, Vasquez and Oliveira were row three, and so on and so forth backwards. Oh, and you got to mention, at the back of row five was Juan Francisco Guevara, and lots of people were commenting on the, he was riding the Wild Wolf BST, and someone saying, he must have the nickname Shay. unavoidable. And then the race, and you go with this, Len, you were there, so...
It was an... anybody who saw it on television knows it. It was an absolutely fantastic race. Seeing the front, I think it was a train of sometimes up to eight riders, just,
We had 13 at one point. When they came down that incredibly long back straight, Julian Ryder counted them, and he went, we've got 13. Well, I mean, who was it? I can't remember who it was. Someone, probably Sofa Racer on Twitter, who is hilarious, came up a few weeks ago and said, Moto3, the only motorsport where you have a peloton.
That's it.
And it was just that, this nose to tail, wheel to wheel to wheel to wheel to wheel, 13 of them in a blooming row. It was fantastic. But of course, during warm-up lap, we saw Vinales pull over off the track, fiddle with the bike a bit, pushed it off the track, had a go at restarting it, dropped it and stomped off.
Yeah, I think he was pretty unhappy. He saw whatever chances he had left, he probably saw them just, going up in smoke. Poor kid.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm not laughing at him at all. I'm laughing at him. It's like, you see him stomping off and you suddenly remember this is a 17-year-old kid. So actually, in those terms, I think he showed great self-control. And thinking about when Marquez got wiped out in the first corner 2 years ago on the 125s, do you remember
I remember that.
Dying swan, toddler tantrum, slamming his fist into the ground and throwing his head back and howling at the sky. It was like, dude, everyone's looking. Stop it. But I mean, what, he was 16 then. So, these are kids. And I think, and for Vinales, they all say, don't they, when you crash because you've made a mistake, it's like, okay, you go back, you apologize to the team. When something like that happens and you haven't even had a chance to start, must be gutted. And Fanati had been up there at the beginning. He was looking really good. And then something happened to his bike. Did you get any idea it was?
I don't know. We didn't see him because he was on the other side of the track. But another right. real disappointment. You know, we were expecting big things from him. I think he started, if I remember correctly, not so well, and he made a few moves and he was getting up toward the front, and then he was gone.
He was sixth at the end of the first lap, then got up to fifth for a few. Then he dropped back. He dropped right back to 10th at one point, was working his way back up to eighth. And then he kind of, no one seemed to really notice. In fact, at lap 9, he was down to 17th. So obviously having this problem. But when he came into the pits, I was watching it on Eurosport, and they were saying that his body language suggested something stop starts like it was misfiring or losing right. power. So he pulled in, but I mean, the front was just brilliant. And I have to take a hit. Simone Corsi, often seen at the front at the beginning of the race, and normally manages to find a reverse gear and go backwards. And he started doing that. And I tweeted saying, oh, Corsi's rearward progression has started early this week. And then he turned it around and came back up to the front. I was like, okay, that was quite impressive.
I have to say the sort of the battle that I got pulled into watching was since my wife and I were watching it with Efrem Vasquez's family, which was, there's nothing, anybody who knows me knows that I don't tend to be a much of a fan of any one rider in any of the classes. I just, I like the racing. But for that race, I was an Efrem fan. I was infected by his family and wanted him to win. And there was all kinds of great cheering going on. It was a whole lot of fun. And he did fairly well. He was the top finisher of the Honda. I mean, he just didn't have the power of the KTMs. These guys were slaughtering him on the straight.
You could see that. Yeah. I mean, if he could get a good close toe, he was managing to just about stay in touch. But if it was side by side, they were blasting him. And Alex Rins, again, was quite good. Now, Johann Zarco, that's Moto2. Who am I talking about? Wasn't Zarco. Who was it who came charging through the pack early on? And, I was starting talking about Simone Corsi a short while ago. Should probably just edit this whole thing out. Just edit my voice out and you go with it.
All right. You know, who really impressed me was Lewis Rossi. And I have to say, I love watching this kid ride because of all of the guys on Moto3 bikes, he's the only one that looks like he fits because he's a tiny little thing.
Yeah. And what happened to him? Because remember, early in the season, he won at Le Mans. He was right up there. I don't know if the team didn't get updates everyone else was getting because they couldn't afford it or what, but he's kind of been anonymous for a few rounds.
Yeah, well, again, so he's on a Honda. You know, I know that at Ferdinand Vasquez's team, they're running some updates that they got from the Honda from Honda factory. Don't know if Lewis Rossi is running those or not.
No. Mind you, Vinales is on a Honda and he's not doing that bad.
True.
And Vasquez, I know what you mean, though. There does seem to be an advantage just developed during the season, certainly. And we had Salom. Now, I'd kind of missed a lot of the Friday and Saturday activity because I was at work and we were quite busy. But Louis Salom had a massive high side on Saturday. He didn't break his collarbone, but they described it as damaged, which, I don't know what that means, but it probably hurt. And then he high-sided again on warm-up. And I believe he'd finished and he finished the race. He won the race and was saying, I'm actually in quite a lot of discomfort at the moment. Do you mind if I go and finish this interview up and go and get some treatment? And you think, blooming heck.
Yeah.
I mean, a collarbone has got to affect your functionality. It's not just pain at that stage. So
you're not going to have very stable shoulders for braking if you've got even if the ligaments are damaged.
Yeah, mind you, remember Colin breaks his collarbone 1 week last year, and then next week gets on the podium at Silverstone. I mean, phenomenal. But of course, Salom's also moved past Vinales now in the table. So we've got Cortese, 51 points with four rounds left. I mean, it must be a nice place to be, but at the same time, there must be that thing of, oh my goodness, if I blow it from here, I'm going to look like a choker.
Yep.
Which brings us back to the Ryder Cup. No, no, it doesn't. I'm joking. But I mean, that's the thing that Troy Bayliss, I remember in 2002, wasn't it, where Colin chased him down and won. He said, you know, if I'm going to lose to anyone, I'd rather lose to him. But considering the lead I had, I lost that. You know, that's not very good. And Salom 51 points behind Cortese, 15 ahead of Vinales.
The thing that I like the most about seeing it so close is none of these guys are going to be riding with the calculator. You know, every single one, they're trying to win because that's all that matters.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the best thing for the racing.
And Cortese does appear to be one of those, if I can get the win, I'll get the win. Yeah. You know, if I can't, it doesn't make any difference. But also this weekend, was it this weekend that Vinales announced that he's remaining in Moto3 for another year?
Yep.
And I suspect they're really going to push him for the title. He must be thinking, right, okay, we've got rid of Tyrrell. We've got rid of Cortese. Please don't let anyone else pop up next year. It's got to be my turn. Because Cortese is going up to Moto2 with Intact GP, which is a new team formed around him, which has got to be nice. Collaboration between Intact Batteries and Kuhn Bao, who are both current sponsors of him, riding a Kalex, but they're going to use WP suspension rather than Olin's, who are owned by KTM WP, which retains his link with them. Not sure how much good that's going to do him because KTM ain't in the MotoGP paddock, but someone obviously thinks there's a bright future for this kid.
Yeah, I hope that works out for him because... You know, not that Olin's are the only thing that work, but it seems like anybody in the past few years that's tried something else, you know, how well has it worked? Bautista and Showa, you know, Kenny Noyes on Bitubo a few years ago. It's, you know, the racing community is a conservative bunch and, you know, and for a reason, because what works, works.
I mean, KTM Austria and Kalex are German or Swiss? German.
I think they're German, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I would imagine WP and Kalex have sort of said, yeah, no, we can make this work with WP, but be interesting to see. Romano Fenati is pretty much out of touch of, there's no way he's going to catch Vinales. He's 59 points behind with four rounds left. He's in fourth. Alex Rins is fifth, 106. Danny Kent on 83 with Alex Masbu and Zulfam and Kai Redding. 2 points, both tied on 81, 2 points behind him. So, it's between the top. Well, it's really between Luis Salom and Maverick Vinales to see who can come second. Cortese would have to have an absolute disaster not to win from here.
Yeah, I think so. And when I caught up with Sandro in the paddock after the race, I asked him. I said, "You must be over the moon." And I thought he was going to be jumping all over the place. And he's a very serious boy. He just said, well, we just need to keep our heads down and keep serious and keep plugging away at it.
I've just got this image, Len, of you leaping out in front of me going, stop!
That's pretty much what it was. I'm glad he's good on the brakes.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, of course, I mean, that happened to Tommy Hill at Silverstone, didn't it? Someone walked out in front of him. Was it Silverstone? No, it was at Assen last time out for BSB. Mechanic stepped in front of him whilst he was coming back onto the grid and locked his front brake and flipped him.
Oops.
And break the chassis in half. Yeah. But anyway, back to Aragon and Moto2 qualifying, which seemed quite up and down. I mean, the impression we got on watching on telly, and like I said, I missed quite a bit of the qualifying, was that from Moto2 onwards, it was dry, they're on slicks, but it wasn't exactly perfect conditions.
Yeah, I think it was pretty much dry. There was a good dry line, but there were some damp spots where they would have liked to be running. So I think they were, threading the needle in some places, and you know, the times reflected that a bit. And the order was, you know, what we would normally expect. It didn't change things too much, but you know, I think a couple of riders did get hit by it, namely Marc Marquez, you know, all the way back in seventh place.
Yeah, I mean, unusual for him. Corsi Espargaro in only front row. Corti Jordi Torres doing very well. And Nico Tirol. And I did wonder, has he finally dialed in this Aspar bike? Or was he dragged up there by Jordi Torres, Tony Elias' replacement, being in front of him? And then we got to the race, and no, he hasn't. So
I think he's chipping away at it. He's figuring it out, but it's proving very tough for him.
Yeah, I mean, we'll come on to the race, and I mean, it was again incredible, fantastically entertaining, edge of the sofa stuff. And we only lost two riders from, as you pointed out quite accurately to me, De Angelis was wiped out by Xavier Simeon, who had the neck to remount and managed two more laps before he had to pull back in. But is that a record that we've only had two DNFs in Moto 2?
Yeah, I think we usually lose that many people in turn one.
Yeah, yeah. But it was, a blazing advert for Jim Zak's murderer class, or Murray Walker would have described it as a ding-dong battle, no doubt. Just so many leader changes. And you had this group, this bunch at the front who were just, I mean, kicking hell out of each other. And quite often, again, we saw someone's really hard but clean move sit someone up, and then two other people get through. And you're like, bloody hell, I've gone from first to fourth.
It was great watching Espargaro, Marquez, and Iannone, because these guys are racing really hard. I don't know, but what you read is that there's not a lot of love lost between them, that they all want to, you know, punish the others. But it was good, hard, clean racing. I didn't see anything that I thought was dirty. I saw a couple things that were pretty harsh, but it was a great, great race to watch.
Yeah. And it just, it start to finish. I mean, it just goes on all the time. People come up and join them. And of course, apologies for my earlier complete mind meld with Simone Corsi. It was Moto 2. Simone Corsi started for the front, drifted to the back, came back up, and then sort of drifted a little bit. But Johann Zarco came absolutely charging through. I was really thinking, yow, this is going to be interesting. He was eighth at the end of the first lap, came up to sixth, then up to then went back a place, then up to fifth. He kind of peaked there, but it did look at one stage he was going to come charging up. Bradley Smith and Scott Redding had their own little sort of race-long battle, but gradually picked people off and made it up to that lead group.
Yeah, it was good to see Bradley up that up that high, because he's had a tough year. I think it's starting to click now, and yeah. having him finish fifth was great. But I think the best of that was actually Scott. Scott had a fantastic race, especially considering his starting position and what he's been through in the last week just before the race.
Yeah, he had his carpal compartment, what do they call it, compartment syndrome operation, which basically involves opening up the arm and cutting a load of muscle sacs so that the blood doesn't get trapped, which removes arm pump. But I think, was it eight laps from the end, he felt his stitches pop?
Yeah, all pretty gruesome. Yeah, he said that he felt the scar opening up, but that he's been taught that you just go, so he just went.
Yeah.
Very impressive.
Yeah, and it was good. I have not heard him speak, but certainly the impression I got from people who did, you know, I've seen the written word, was that it wasn't like a, pain is just one of the things we have to deal with. It was just really fact-based, just saying, well, yeah, but, you know, if you can't deal with a bit of pain, you shouldn't be in this job. And Scott managed, I did feel quite sorry for Andrea Iannone. You had Iannone, Marquez, Espargaro, you know, pretty, they'd pulled a small gap and the three of them were beating each other up. And then was it about two laps to go and Espargaro managed to make a break? And I don't know if I missed it or the cameras missed it, but did Marquez or Iannone hold the other one up? He just seemed to give him enough of a breathing space that Paul was able to pull out and make a bit of a gap.
Yeah, I think they were. I think there was a lot of hard racing going on behind them, that they were just slowing themselves down. And I think that's, you know, Paul took the opportunity and said, right, this is where I change the rhythm and go.
Because he held him off, and in the end, he was 1.5 seconds clear. Marc Marquez got past Iannone, and I think he sat him up to the point that Scott Redding just did one of those almost Rossi or Lorenzo-like, no one's expecting it, and just, boom, Jesus, where did he come from?
Yeah.
Got in front, I thought, hang on, there's no way you're going to be able to hold him off on that long straight. If I know it was after the straight, wasn't he got by? But, Scott held him off and got the last podium, which was amazing. And, again, you've got this, you look at the, what was it, we had the top six were within 3 seconds of each other. You know, just over a second behind, you've got another group of, oh my God, 10 or 11 people really together. We had Bradley Smith was fifth behind Iannone. Then we had Johann Zarco, Simone Corsi, Jordi Torres. And he's only been on this bike, what, two or three rounds?
Yeah. He's a fast kid. He's, you know, he's leading the CEV championship, so he knows his way around. But, you know, he's having to get used to a new chassis and new tires. So it's really impressive what he's doing here.
And I would imagine, I mean, this is one of the things I've heard, like Johnny Ray was saying when he went across, and Cal Crutchlow, when I was talking to him or listening to him speak at Silverstone last year, you know, what's the most noticeable difference? Everybody in this paddock is just so blooming quick.
Yeah.
And, you know, when you're top of the CEV and then you join Moto2, you're like, yeah, but here you've got the top of last year's CEV and CIV. And, you know, World Supersport and a few other, you know, series that are checking in. So we had Torres, Claudio Corti, who's sadly now been sacked. We had Anthony West 10th in the dry. Good lad.
Impressive,
and Thomas Luthi, I don't know what's happened to Luthi. At the beginning of the season, I had him down as a championship contender. And he's, don't know what's happened. Esteban Rabat and Nico Tirola. I don't know what's happened to Nico Tirola either. You know, that is a great racing team, Aspar, but and he was 125 champion. He's a bloody good rider, we know that, but nah.
Yeah, it's definitely taking him a while to, you know, I don't know if it's the four-stroke engine or if it's the bigger bike, but it's taking him a while to figure it out. You know, he's certainly not doing badly. He's doing a lot better than he used to.
Yeah.
But you know, definitely chipping away from it. He's not the phenom that Marquez was when he went to the class.
But it's strange with a control engine, with a lot less variables than you'll find in the MotoGP. We do seem to get these. I'm just noticed in 16th place, Mika Kallio, 0.072 of a second behind Dominic Agatou, who got the last point. Mika Kallio was on a podium a couple of races ago. You know, he's been right up there. Axel Pons, fair enough, well done, he finished. Julian Simon, another potential world champion. Oh, another world champion from 125. And notably, Gino Rea in 22nd. And I mention that because you got a chance to briefly speak to Gino.
I did, yeah. I caught up with Gino in the paddock afterward, and he was on his way out. We just had a quick chat about how things are going and what he's thinking about for next year. So, yeah, why don't we go ahead and run that?
Well, we'll run Scott first. So you had a chat to Scott Redding, and then just start straight after Scott. We'll go straight into Gino.
Okay, let's go.
Okie doke.
So fantastic today. You must be over the moon.
Yeah, I was pretty happy with the result after not being in the top eight for the whole weekend. It was a bit of a surprise to me as well once we start to find the rhythm.
Yeah, we saw that the starting position, I mean, wasn't great, third row, and you must have really, really hauled and really gotten into some fights to get up there.
Yeah, I think I was in 10th or 11th at one point, but I was really trying hard. I had some pain with the hand, but I turned it to using aggression for the riding. And, you know, it was, for me, one of the toughest races, you know, with the straight. You know, I had the speed to go with Marquez, but every time in the straight he was going, but really happy and proud for myself and for the team after working so hard. And it was a bit of a gamble with the operation, and a lot of people didn't agree with my choice, and
they thought you shouldn't have ridden.
Yeah, they said not so much ridden, but not to have the operation now. But
ah, okay.
I said I'd take the gamble and I'll ride, you know. And
was it bothering you a lot?
Well, it split open halfway through the race on the brakes and it started bleeding again. And I tried to ride this morning with no painkillers and it wasn't possible to ride. I was 2 seconds slower. So I took the painkillers and it was then a lot better for the race.
All right. Yeah, considering your starting position and then how well you did, if you had started up front, if you had started where you finished, how do you think you might have done? I know that racing is, you know, isn't a woulda, coulda, shoulda game, but what do you think might have happened?
I think it was good to start where I started because there was no real pressure and not to fight hard in the beginning, just to start to work with it with my hand to bring it in a little bit was almost nice to have that and to see the guys fighting a bit and just working into it a bit instead of going directly from the front and going hard. But it was a tough race.
Yeah, yeah, looked like it. So how does this set you up for the rest of the year? Does it change how you approach things or?
No, not really. I'm just going race for race, you know, and it'd be nice to finish third in the championship, but I think I need one or two more podiums for sure. One or two podiums. You know, it's a couple of points and it'll be tight, but it's my target, you know, so I'm going to work hard for that.
Yeah, yeah. And any plans for next year yet?
Nothing yet, not to go GP. I think maybe we're going to stay where we are and we go in this direction.
So you've got the opportunity to stay with the team?
Yeah, I got the opportunity to stay here with the guys and it's a really good team. The bike's good. Everyone here is like a big family to me, so I don't really want to leave them as such anyway, so we're just trying to find a good way to find a solution for next year and more in the future.
Okay, that's great. One last question. I know that in the past, you being quite a big guy on the small bikes, you know, people have said that your weight is a hindrance for you. It actually looks like you've lost quite a bit of weight. Is that something that you've been working on?
Well, I've been losing weight, but I've been getting taller, so I'm not actually losing any weight. I'm getting skinnier, but taller, and I'm still around 75 kilos, and you know, between me and my teammate, there's 18 kilos with full leather suit on, which is, you put 18 kilos on your back and go running, you'll feel the difference, you know. And it's a shame that some of the people don't see it. They think it's just weight, it doesn't mean anything, da da da. But it does when you're within 0.2 seconds, it makes a difference.
Oh yeah, especially when everybody's got identically the same power.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is Len Padilla from MotoPodcast.com, and we're talking to Gino Rea. So it looked like it was kind of a tough race. How did it go out there?
Yeah, it was a tough race, to be honest. You know, we still haven't got the bike dialed in the dry conditions. In the wet, of course, we don't have the same problem, so I'm able to ride it how I want to, and we're fast in the wet. Yesterday was, in the morning, was fastest for most of the session, but in the dry we just need more development work, and unfortunately the development we're doing is at the race meeting, so we're trying different stuff. And when we do have the wet days, okay, it's good because I'm fast, but we don't develop the bike, and then when it comes to the dry, it's very difficult. So
yeah, and these missed conditions must be about the worst thing you could have for a weekend.
Yeah, well, I mean, if it stayed like that for the whole weekend, if the race was wet, it would have been perfect for me, because I can be right in the front, but when it's wet and then dry, especially in our situation, the bike is just not developed enough, so it's more difficult for us. But just have to keep plugging away and see if we can improve it.
Yeah. And any good plans for next year yet?
Hopefully stay in the Moto2 paddock. In my opinion, there's a lot of unfinished business. I still need to prove myself, especially in the dry conditions. Obviously, I've already done it in the wet. So yeah, I'd like to stay in this paddock and see what we can do next year.
All right. Well, we hope to see you there.
Yeah. So that was a great chat there with Scott, and I have to say I was really impressed by Scott. He's I think he has the reputation for being a bit of a wild child, but he was a really well-behaved young man, was you know, very nice during the, while we were chatting with him. He even went so far as, when we came into the hospitality, going over and getting a drink for my wife, asking her if she wanted something. So really really nice kid, and it was nice to hear what he had to say.
Yeah, and I've spoken to him a couple of times before, and he's very thoughtful.
Definitely, yeah. I think he was also probably in a bit of pain. He was, you know, he was holding his wrist, and gave me his left hand to shake after we were done when I left. But yeah, and overall, he was, you know, he was subdued, but he was very, very happy about how he finished.
Yeah, and Gino Rea finding it tough, but he's shown flashes. He just needs, if he could get a few points under his belt, someone might, you know, keep him on for next year. Let's hope.
Yeah, yeah, that's what he's looking to do, looking to stay. You know, and then the other thing that's kind of grumbling around the paddock. I don't want to, you know, drop any names, but someone who I know who's connected to, let's just say one of the, you know, top three teams in Moto2. Was grumbling a little bit, thinking that that there might be some favoritism towards Marquez, that there might be some things that would be anomalies in scrutineering that they get just sort of brushed under the rug, and he gets through. You know, none of the things that I heard sounded terrible. You know, one of the examples was if there's 115 decibel sound limit and the bike tested at 116.5, that he was given a dispensation. Now, of course, I don't think that the extra power generated by making 1.5 decibels more of noise probably isn't appreciable, but rules are there for a reason, right? I mean, you draw the line somewhere, even if it's arbitrary, and that's what you make your judgments based on. So it's
that brings me back to, was it you spoke to Tommy Aquino, or was it Jim? I can't remember.
Yeah, I spoke to Tommy up here in
that's right,
in
and he was saying about the difference between a Moto2 bike and you like, you know, the super sport bikes he'd ridden before. And he was saying, in and of itself, a lot of the changes seem insignificant. You got a titanium bolt instead of a aluminium one. But then when all of them are titanium and every little excess bit of carbon's taken off and thrown away, you know, and cumulatively, it makes a completely different beast. And I wonder if they're just thinking that Marquez's team are just chipping here and chipping there. But, you know, scrutineering's there for a reason. And if they've said there's nothing wrong, I mean, there was a big Twitter storm again of people coming back to this. Well, you know, Marquez, he's had everything bought for him. Someone tweeted that he'd had, when he was in Minimoto, he had a telemetry guy and a mechanic. And you're like, well, I don't believe he's from a particularly wealthy background. I just think you could say the same about Rossi. Once the talent's been identified, people will invest in that talent.
Exactly.
In time, money, and effort. And, you know, you don't, unless you know, you've got an incredibly rich family who buy you all that support, you've still got to be blooming quick to get there, to get to where he is. But I don't believe he is from that kind. I think he's from a very normal background, and he has an incredible talent. You know,
the two classic cases of what you're saying are Tito Rabat and Marc Marquez. Like you said, Marc Marquez, you know, very normal family. The kid has amazing talent. He had people spotted early, and they've been supporting him since then. You know, and we're seeing the fruit of that. Tito Rabat is also very good, but he might not be where he is if it weren't for having a very, very, very wealthy family.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and Axel Pons, you know, he if dad wasn't who dad was, he basically keeps mechanics in jobs, doesn't he? Breaking bikes most weeks.
Yeah, he does. And himself, unfortunately.
Yeah. Unfortunately, he's had a heck of a time. But again, you know, cracking race, and we think, I mean, we've got a 48-point lead for Marquez ahead of Pol Espargaró's on 210, who's himself got a 32-point lead over Andrea Iannone in third, who's only 12 ahead of Tom Luthi. Now, there was me saying earlier, oh yeah, you know, what's happened to Tom Luthi? Well, he's still fourth, and I mean, Scott Redding's 35 points behind him in fifth. Mika Kallio in sixth. How did Mika do that? A bit of stealth riding going on. So, you know, not a huge surprise to see Marquez pulling out in the front. I don't think anyone's going to be able to bridle him this year. Looking forward to him coming up to MotoGP next year. Pol Espargaró and Andrea Iannone, obviously Iannone is coming up. I think Pol Espargaró, sorry, and Scott Redding, I was going to say, I think are two riders who have really earned a MotoGP ride, and unfortunately rather looks like the only things they'd have open to them would be CRT, and I don't think either of them are particularly interested in that.
No,
I don't know, Paul might be, because Aleth is doing all right, but
He's doing all right, but I think both of them, and I hope this is what they're thinking. I'd really rather see them, you know, stand out in Moto2, have another crack at the championship, rather than go ride CRTs and, you know, I hate to say it, but just sort of disappear.
Yeah. I don't think you can force teams to say, right, the Moto2 champion must the next year be given a prototype ride in MotoGP, because it doesn't work like that.
There just aren't enough rides, unfortunately. No.
But you would, yeah, I think someone put it into words the other day and said, I think a lot of them will think it's better to be at the front of the Moto2 pack on television every week and on the podium and having your name talked about than be fighting for 16th or 15th in the MotoGP paddock.
Yeah, I think so. And the thing is, you know, Paul and Scott, they're both, you know, they're both still very, very young. It's not like they need to jump to the top class yet.
And I mean, having been around the paddock there, the Espargaro brothers, the pair of them, just seem such cheerful, mutually supportive, nice guys, you know.
They're very, very tight family. You can always, they're always there for each other. You know, Aleix was in the paddock in the park for me, waiting for when Paul came in, gave him a big hug. And they just seen, I actually ran into both of them in the paddock and got quick words with them, but it's in Spanish, so they're not going to be in this show. And just, you know, really happy, friendly guys. I have to say, very, very, very different from the reception I got from Mark Marquez's team, who his press manager, who used to be Hector, who is Jorge Lorenzo's old guy, told me that they only did previously arranged interviews.
Yeah.
So I said, okay.
You see, I was told the same very, very politely and very friendlily by Gavin Matheson at which is, you know, the factory Yamaha MotoGP teams guy last year. So this year, he absolutely pulled it out and managed to get me a slot on Thursday, but I couldn't make it down on Thursday. I didn't arrive till the Friday, so I missed it again. But you expect that at the top level. I think this is part of what people resist or find slightly off-putting about Marquez, that it's already brand Beckham in football. You know, people are going, what do you mean brand Beckham? He's just a good, though not brilliant, footballer. What he's been brilliant at is that marketing positioning thing. Well, again, I'd say, you know, yes, he has a more engaging personality, but it's exactly what Valentino Rossi's done. So many of the criticism aimed at the kids coming up, you know, they're overprotected, they're given all the best kit. It's like, well, let's think back 15 years. That's exactly what the Biaggis and the Gibbonals were complaining about, and the Caparossis to a degree, about Rossi coming up.
Yeah, I don't think any of this has ever changed.
No, exactly. No. Anyone coming up who's suddenly better than you must have a reason other than talent to be better than you. So we got to MotoGP, and basically, you just summed it up in one phrase there.
Yeah, one Spanish guy passed another Spanish guy, and that was kind of the race. It was a brilliant display of riding, but it just wasn't a race up front, you know, past lap six.
No, and I mean, Danny won't got past Jorge, who tried keep staying with him, and did you see that out of the seat moment he had? He's had a couple of those recently. Ouch. And that was was
pushing hard.
Scary.
And I have to say the pass that Danny made was super, super impressive, because that spot on the track is a scary enough spot as it is, because it's just so fast.
Yeah.
I've not seen many passes there in general.
Mm.
And to me that was the pass of a fighter. Not Danny gets branded as this guy that if he doesn't get out front and escape, then he's nothing. He took the fight to Jorge, passed him, and ran away.
Well, remember last year at Jerez, and Jorge gapped him, got him, went past, but he didn't do that. Oh, okay, sorry, I didn't realize you wanted to overtake me. I'll drop back a few bike lengths. He actually fought back. Now, it didn't work, but I remember then thinking, wow, that's not like you, Danny.
No, but he got in there, yeah.
But I think the biggest point for this season with Pedrosa, other than the fact he's another year old, I mean, he's just turned 27. So he's not a kid anymore. As someone said, it's the first season since he's been in GPs that he's not hurt himself.
This is true. This is true. Maybe we're seeing what Danny can really do.
Touch wood, fingers crossed. And when you consider that, I think, considering how early silly season happened, if Casey hadn't announced his retirement, I think Danny would be looking for a ride. I don't think he'd have stayed in HRC. I think it would have been Stoner and Marquez for next year, because I think Marquez was nailed on to get that.
Very well could have been. Yeah, he might have ended up, who knows, at Yamaha or who knows where.
Yeah. So we had Lorenzo got the whole shot. Pedrosa overtook him fairly early on. And the next time Jorge saw Danny, it was to shake hands in Parc Fermé. And they're getting along. It's really strange. But behind them, initially, we had Ben Spies and the Tech Toire points train, which was initially Cal followed by Dovi. In between them, very quickly, was Stefan Bradl, who then went past Cal, then went past Ben. And I was thinking, wow, he's looking like he might try and catch Jorge. And then he crashed, which was a real shame. But because Stefan Bradl looked really on it this weekend, he seemed really comfortable with the track and the bike in all conditions. I don't know if you saw him coming back in. I would imagine he was gutted.
Yeah, I actually didn't see him afterwards. I did see him on television when I watched it again.
Mm.
And he was just making the movements, making the motions of, you know, somebody who just ran it in. Everything was going fine until it wasn't. You know,
yeah.
He threw it in there fast and the front end went away and that was that. You know, it was fairly early in the race and it was a right-hand corner, which there aren't too many of at Aragon. So I don't know. You know, I don't know. I don't know if he didn't have the right side of the tire fully up to temperature yet or what might have happened. But, you know, maybe that is what happened to him.
And then we had and Rossi, of course, had a heck of a tough time. Was it on the first lap? I think it was, wasn't it? Yeah, it was.
Second? Yeah.
No, it was first lap. The lap charts got him plumb last as they come across the line. Down the long back straight, and Johnny Ray braked a little. Well, Rossi said, you know, Johnny braked a little bit early, earlier than Rossi was planning to, and was slightly, it wasn't right against the edge of the track, so Rossi thought he had room. And thinking, oh, I might do a brakes off around the outside thing here. And then Johnny just moved slightly across, didn't know he was there. And I think they did just touch. Johnny carried on his race. Rossi had to run off, rejoined at the back, made his way back up through the pack, then ran off again and finished eighth, 12 seconds behind Johnny Ray in the end. So no one's real fault. You know, it was just one of those things. And I don't think either of them were sort of blaming, well, it didn't really affect Johnny, but Rossi wasn't blaming him. It was just, yeah, one of those things. But it was sort of, it put Misano in a bit of context, I think. Not a brilliant weekend for Ducati.
No, not at all. I mean, I think I looked at the lap chart for Rossi later, and it seemed like his times were, you know, decent and consistent, but they also didn't seem like anything that was going to have him finishing, you know, really even on the rostrum.
No. Oh, no. I don't think that he was ever in threatening that. And Nicky had a weird and horrible crash.
Yeah, poor Nicky. I think he had the best luck in the world and the worst luck in the world all at the same time. You know, that could have ended really badly. I think everybody's, you know, heart was in their throat when they saw it, and just it all came out okay.
Yeah, if anyone hasn't seen it, it is on it is up on the net. Basically ran off. Yeah, it was gravel.
Well, yeah, the place where he ran off is one of the few places at the track that doesn't have these huge asphalt aprons. You know, he ran off in an area that was first gravel, then he crossed perpendicularly, you know, the superbike section of the track, which is that extension off the last corner. Then he ran onto grass. The only, you know, I kept wondering why is he holding on? Why hasn't he bailed out yet?
Yeah.
And the only thing that I could think was maybe he was waiting to get to the apron that he thought was there. You know, maybe he was waiting for that bit where he was going to be able to break. Because then just before he hits the wall, you can see in the video, he's just, you know, foot down on the back brake.
But the other thing is, the wall had banners hung over it, advertising banners.
It was a tire wall, yeah.
He didn't think that that was an air wall, an air fence, did he?
Well, he might have. Maybe he just at the end figured, well, you know, I'm already here. I'll just you know, crunch into the air fence and.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But he went into that and he got flipped head over and land. And you could see where he was coming down and then went out of sight of the cameras. He was going to land flat on his back. And that, yeah, if there's a curb there, you just think, oh, my God.
Well, he did. There's somebody posted some pictures of that a photographer took from the other side of that wall in the service road.
Oh, wow.
And in the just Nicky had the good luck to land where there was nothing. You know, he did. He landed on his back on the ground, but there was nothing there. Not 10 meters away from him, there's a marshal on a scooter. A little further up the road is the trailer that they use to, you know, drag bikes around when they've gone off track. So just all kinds of horrible stuff that he could have run into. And again, he just had the good luck to miss all of that.
There, but for the grace of God.
Exactly.
So, yeah, I was just a relief that he was okay. And he'd had a bit of a crash fest that weekend, and he'd gone down in qualifying and walked off holding his wrist again. It was like, oh.
Well, the other crash that he had was in the same spot. He ran off again in entry of turn 16.
Ouch.
Which is a, you know, fast corner. Yeah.
We had Alvaro Bautista was ahead of Johnny Ray, who was trying to chase him down, but Johnny was saying he was playing around with all sorts of different switchery bits, trying to get a different, you know, playing around with the traction control. And he said, you know, he thought, oh, that's easier. But my lap time hasn't improved at all. So he had to settle for seventh in the end, but I thought that was very creditable. And then we had the proper battle of the weekend. Well, the one we got to see, because we didn't see Aleix Espargaró and Randy Depuñet beating each other up again. Those two are just brilliant. And both of them beat Hector Barbera.
Yeah.
That's not good.
I think that reflects badly both on the satellite Ducati and on Hector. I think it's he'll be on a CRT next year, which, given the way things are in the paddock this year, is probably really where he belongs.
Yeah. I mean, I tweeted a bit of a tongue-in-cheek saying he's just getting to know the CRT guys because that's who he's going to be with next year. But only 1 second ahead of Espargaró was Carol Abraham. And now I know Carol's still a little bit busted up, but he's also going to be in CRT next year. So, and then you consider that Rossi was 13 seconds ahead of Carol, having been plumb last at one point. Not great. But the real race was the Tech Toire points train and the fourth Yamaha rider, Ben Spies. And Yes, I'm British. I think Cal's a very engaging character. I think he's a great racer. I'm really chuffed he's staying at Tech Toire. But, you know, you see tweets going, oh, I see boring old Dovi got on the podium again. I think, what's boring about watching him ride a bike? Nigel Mansell was the most entertaining racing driver I'd ever seen. But I didn't want to hear him interviewed because he was dull. But I don't think Dovi is actually myself. I just think he's a nice guy, but he's a quiet guy, but he's a focused guy. Watching him on that bike, it's Lorenzo in black. He is so smooth.
Yeah, he's really good to watch. And I have to say, as far as how he is personally, you know, I don't know any of these guys up close, but I had the good fortune on Saturday. I hooked up with David Emmett. And followed him around and went to the post QP briefings with several of the riders.
Yeah.
And I have to say, listening to Dovi was a real eye opener, because I think I've probably already always had the same impression, you know, that he's just kind of a quiet, boring guy, to put it bluntly.
Yeah.
But he seems, you know, the way that he was talking about you know, the selection process of the tires and which tire he'd like to use and for which reasons and how they respond and all of that made me think that, you know, and it's probably the case of all of these guys, you know, none of these guys are dummies, but he really came across as a very, very bright guy, as a guy who really puts a lot of thinking into it. And he was also, you know, very friendly and engaging when we were talking to him. So it was a real eye opener.
And I interviewed him in the Tech Toire hospitality tent at Silverstone just after the race, and obviously he'd crashed out at Silverstone, and it wasn't the easiest thing for him to do. And he's at a coffee table perched on a bar stool on his own. Oh, I've forgotten the name now, but their press officer, she took me across to introduce him. The other side of the tent, Cal was being absolutely mobbed because remember, this was where he'd broken his foot and he'd had to do these fitness tests, and he basically lied about how much it was hurting and had had this great race. And he was just, but he wasn't, he was pissed off. He'd crashed, Ovi, but he was so engaging. And like you say, he'd listen to the question. He'd really think about it. I'm impressed with him. I'm hoping for the best for him next year. With Ducati, I'm not sure his style suits it, but then that's his style on the Yamaha, which has changed from his style on the Honda. So he might be more adaptable to people than people let on. And it was a great move to get past Cal, and then the defensiveness of holding Cal off was really, really impressive. You know,
yeah, and it worked. He was riding tidily and tightly. And forcing Cal into overriding, and Cal went wide a few times and just couldn't get past him.
No, and I mean it was just over 0.1 of a second that he tipped him by, and Ben again unable to keep up, and I don't get it. But I would say the alien population in the MotoGP paddock, with Casey out injured, is down to two.
There's two
Pedrosa
of them.
And Lorenzo. That's it.
Yeah, and getting back to Ben, what you said in his briefing, you know, he was saying all the right things, but he just didn't sound convinced.
No.
You know, he said that that Misano wasn't bad, that things were starting to click, that, you know, that he'd finally had a race that was good. But he just kind of seemed like he just wanted to go out and be steady and just finish a race. It didn't seem to be a lot of fire there.
No. And I'm not sure how much there will be next year, because he's going to he's going to the Ducati Junior team.
Yep.
They'll have exactly the same bikes, supposedly, allegedly. Still sponsored by Pramac. I don't know how much he's going to feel. It doesn't feel like a move that he's said, right, this hasn't worked for me here. I'm going to go and do something completely different. Right, Ducati, look, talk to me. What can we do together? It sort of feels like, yeah, I suppose I'll go back to World Superbike, BMW, yeah, maybe come back to MotoGP with them and the companies. Ducati, what, you want me? Oh, really? Okay.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just like sort of...
It does seem like that from the outside. I mean, I always think that these guys are racers, that they want nothing more than to race, and every one of them thinks that they can win. But there does seem to be... I don't know. Maybe he's just got other things going on, or maybe things haven't been going well for so long that it just, you know, beats you up a bit.
I mean, and Dovi was adamant. I need a factory bike. I know I had one. I wasn't able to win on it. Now I've come to Yamaha, and I thought he'd earned that ride. However, if you look at it again, real world, economically, Rossi is still going to bring in gazillions.
It doesn't even matter where he finishes.
No. So that seat had gone. They don't do satellite teams with full factory spec bikes. They never have. They're close, I believe, but not that close. So, but again, Dovi has a very good chance of finishing third in the table. Just to get through, we've got Lorenzo's on 290 points, Pedrosa on 257, so 33-point separation. And as we mentioned earlier, if Danny wins all four races, Jorge can afford to come third three times if he comes second in the other time. And that's it, job done. Casey's on 186, so he can mathematically not win the championship. So that's finished. He'd need 104 points. But only 7 points behind Casey is Dovi. And that is, I mean, he's 44 points clear of Cal, 7 points clear of Rossi and Bautista, who are both on the same points. Then Bradle, 13 behind them on 115, so on and so forth down. But if Dovi can finish ahead of Casey, I mean, maybe that's part of, I know Jim was saying the other week that he doesn't think they're bothered about third and fourth places. But I think we're not bothered by it. I think they are.
Well, it's probably not his target, but I'm sure he'd rather have third than fourth at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're, I think, this whole thing of team orders, I think, is a absolute red herring. I don't think he'd listen to them. I don't think, and I think knowing that, they wouldn't even bother suggesting it.
Yeah, I mean, I think maybe if it were tighter, maybe if there were really something to be gained by, you know, by your notional teammate being able to help you, but I don't think it's even close enough for anybody to help.
And is there also a, I know that they've spoken about, HRC spoken about being a good teammate before, very much in 2006 after the Estoril incident, but is there not a cultural thing with the Japanese and FACE that they don't do that sort of thing? Because think about it, where have we seen team orders? Ferrari in Formula One every week, just about. You know, Aprilia in World Superbike.
Oh, God.
Before.
Horribly, obviously, lately.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was. Did you hear the comment someone made? Eugene stuck his leg out to say, quite blatantly, yeah, go by. And someone said, no, he had to let Max by because he had cramp in his leg. That's why he put his leg out to try and get rid of the cramp.
Yeah, that was it.
I mean, yeah, I would imagine team boss would have said to Eugene, subtle, the word, does it mean anything? I'm not thinking it.
Yeah.
But yeah, you can't blame it. It's soul destroying. I was still sort of half watching Formula One when I remember watching Barrichello pull over, absolutely, almost like he pulled into a bus stop to have a fag and let Schumacher past, and you could see his body language, he was gutted, and then Schumacher was patronizing enough to give him one back at the end of the season when it didn't make any difference. It's like, hey, thanks, mate. So I don't know, I don't think it'll happen, but time will tell. Japan in 2 weeks,
in a week, in yeah, almost 2 weeks.
Yeah, in 10 days, week next weekend.
And then, of course, three on the bounce.
Yeah, exactly. Week after week after week.
So I think this will be one of these things that if Casey comes back and he's healthy, it'll all be okay. But if he's still having some lingering issues, it's going to be a slog for him.
Oh, no, absolutely. Yeah, it's not only going to be a slog for him, I think I just hope he doesn't risk. What I'm finding amazing, though, is he raced the day after he did it. How can he be doing? How can he have needed so much time, or how could he race then when since then he's needed all his time off?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, from what he said, it was a matter of the pain not being too bad, but the potential damage from a crash could have been very bad, and they hadn't identified that, you know, at Indianapolis. I don't know. Maybe that's the case. Maybe he just wanted to race, or maybe he just doesn't want to race now. Who knows?
Yeah. I suppose as well, after he'd had more in-depth scans, they might have said, wow, dude, this could really, do long-term damage if you keep riding on it. Now we do have one more interview to go, because you managed to get the inimitable and always entertaining Ian Wheeler.
I did, yeah. Ian was my host this weekend. He took good care of us, and that was really nice to talk to him. And he had been dropping hints about a bombshell, so I went and tracked him down and tried to find out what he was talking about.
Here we go.
So lots of bombshell news today. They turned out to be a bit of damp squib. So you got anything for us?
Well, yeah, these bombshells, they're there and then they disappear. So there'll be more coming along.
The ordnance team came and defused them.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're getting too good at this.
So anything else? Liking. Any other dirt for us?
Yeah, well, I think maybe we'd be a little bit surprised about who lines up on the CRT grid next year. World Championship under their belt. Don't want to say too much, but it was 2009. It wasn't MotoGP and it wasn't 125, so you can figure that one out for yourself. It's a good possibility we'll see him on a CRT bike next year.
Okay, we're going to have to take a quick look at the stats. All right, thanks a lot.
Okay.
Lovely stuff. So, yeah, great thanks to Ian for that, and also to yourself, Len, for running around with your recording device and getting the guys to talk.
Yeah, well, it was a lot of fun. It was a great weekend.
Yeah, yeah. We also had BSB at Silverstone. They'd come back from Assen. This was the middle of the three showdown rounds, as they're calling them. And blooming Alex Lowe's absolutely on fire. Did you get to see these?
Oh, yeah. They were just fantastic. I've seen Alex steadily getting better this year, being on the WFR bike, which is not always the best bike. But he's, as of late, you know, and this weekend, just on fire. Just, you know, amazing, amazing how fast he's going.
Yeah, I mean, you look at last year, he was with WFR Honda on a very kind of, well, let's see how you get on race-by-race basis. Suddenly, he's doing really well. Lots of people looking at him, talking to him. And I think his team kind of, I don't know, the impression I get is they didn't really, they said, we want to tie you down. But it wasn't to reward him for what he'd done so far and to give him some, you know, a good grounding to go forward. It was more to stop other people getting him. So they didn't really offer him anything that you'd like what you'd expect, considering how well he was doing. So then he had that split and he went off and rode for a couple of other people, had a couple of wild cards in other series. And he really does look like he's come home. And he seems happy there. And I think they've realized just how quick he is. That bloody pass for race two win. Unbelievable. I mean, that was Josh Brooks-esque. Really clean, but wow. And Shakey was just, I think he was like,
I don't think Shakey thought it was possible.
No, I think he was quite taken aback and he's like, oh, bugger. Okay, you're going to have that one then. Josh Brooks, yeah, bit off his game, as you've said. Tommy Hill, yeah.
Yeah, I just don't know what's happening with Tommy. He's...
don't know if he was shaken up by what happened at Assen, which he just had a terrible, terrible time. But really, we're looking at... It's between Byrne, Brooks, and Lowe's. Tommy, he's not out of it mathematically at all, but I think he'd need a couple of disasters up front for him to get there. My view is Alex Lowe's definitely one to watch for the future, as his brother Sam, but he's only really found himself in contention because of the six-gun showdown format.
Exactly, yeah. If it had been straight points for the year... I mean, I haven't done the math, but I don't think he'd be there. And I think he's the classic case of, you know, he and his team have really done well based on, you know, the way the rules in BSP have gone. Because, you know, WFR weren't a top team.
No.
When, you know, I think they were sort of an Evo Plus team, you could call them almost.
Yeah. Yeah. They could afford a little bit more than Evo, which pushed them out the Evo class, but not enough to fight with the guys at the front.
They were never up front, you know, two years ago.
But I think Shaky Byrne or Josh Brooks, I'd be more than happy to see either of them guys win it. Well, I mean, whoever wins it deserves to win it, you could argue.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'd say it were an even bet if they were finishing at, say, I don't know, Cadwell or Elton. But when you think that they're finishing it up a triple header at Brands, I mean, I don't think that could play more into Shaky's hands.
No, home circuit, he always does well there. And he's... got an old enough and clever enough head not to be frazzled by the pressure. He's won before, you know, he's been champion before. Oh goodness, how many different, he's done it on Ducati, Honda, and now this will be Kawasaki. That's quite something.
When you talk about not being frazzled and, you know, keeping his head, I was so impressed with the way that he was riding at Silverstone. You know, he didn't win, granted, Alex took them both. But the way that he would take those incredibly wide sweeping lines, which, you know, works at Silverstone, with Alex so close to him, you know, anybody else, I think, would have been a little freaked out, wouldn't have done it, would have looked to see if somebody's there. He was confident, he did it, and 99 times out of 100, it worked. Just, you know, really, really incredible riding. The word that I wrote here in the notes was, you know, situational awareness. He knew exactly where he was and where the other guy was.
Absolutely.
Really confident riding.
Yeah, very, very impressive. And something equally impressive is the MCN Fantasy Road Race update. Jim has leapfrogged both myself and Jules. I thought we'd actually done all right this weekend, but we've dropped places. Jules is now the bottom of the host, 68th on 1433. I'm 28 points ahead of him on 1461 in 57th, but Jim has leapt right up to 1487, so he's 28 points ahead of me in 48th place. But what I'm most delighted to announce or to update people with is Toby Hurst and Team Mofo are still the number one in our league, and they're still the number one overall. So damn well done. And everybody, it's the last, finishes on Friday night, it's the last transfer window. So it's your last chance to catch a chance to, you know, get rid of the people who aren't performing and put some people in who are.
So if Toby wins this thing, he gets a special prize, right? He gets to listen to a podcast for free or something?
Well, if he wins the overall thing, he gets a Yamaha FZ8.
Okay. Well, I was thinking within the Motopod group.
Oh, no. He just gets... well, basically, if he goes to Mississippi, he can have a small brewery, because John Hart knows us so much, we're giving them away to listeners now.
Ah, there you go.
Oh, dear. John, there you go. There's your mention. Right. I think we've covered all the points, all the bases. We've got some great little punchy interviews to go there. We've got to look forward to... we've got Manicor this weekend coming.
Yeah, yeah.
6th and 7th.
Closing out World Superbike.
Yeah, the end of World Superbike. IMAX is... you know, unless Hector Barber turns up to do a... wild card ride, the operative word being wild. That's unfair. He's only done it once this season. Alex De Angelis actually would be a better bet, you think? Or someone just step Jules Cluzel up. What's he on? No, he's on a Honda, isn't he?
Just ride right into him.
Yeah. You know, I think it looks like Max is going to do it. And I'm sure everyone is waiting with bated breath to see if he does another cringeworthy prepared celebration. It's like, Max, it ain't you. I know I defend Lorenzo's right to do them. That's fine. He's a young kid. He's learning. Max, you're 40 years old. And when your wife smiles at you, try and smile back, dude. Anyway, we'll see. Tom Sykes still in with a realistic chance. Marco Melandri, I don't think he is. I don't even know if it's mathematically possible now. No. You'd think all the pressure would have been off him when he heard that Ben Spies wasn't coming to join him next year, because that would have, I think, shaken him up a bit. He'd have thought, damn. You know, I don't think he'd have been seen as the number one rider if Ben had joined. Yeah. Anyway, Len, always a pleasure.
Yeah, great to talk to you again, Martin.
And we've got some really weird and wacky time zone deals to have to match up now for the next few weeks.
Lots of Japan, early mornings.
Then Sepang. And obviously, that's going to be quite emotional because it's a year since we were there when we lost Marco Simoncelli. So that'd be quite an interestingly and difficult thing for people to deal with. And then, of course, Phillip Island, and then back for Valencia. Will it still be open when we get there? That's the question.
Yeah, I don't know. And unfortunately, I'm going to miss Valencia this year, which is too bad. I'm going to be nowhere. I'm actually going to be in Australia, but at the wrong time. So I'm going to miss Phillip Island and I'm going to miss Valencia. Oh, well.
Yeah, well, that's just not good enough.
No, not very good.
We have to change our lives. Yeah. Like I say, if Bill Gates wants to donate or Richard Branson, then maybe we can go pro.
There you go.
Speaking of GoPro, they make cameras, don't they? Right. We will end this out. Thank you very much, everybody. And Len and Jules in advance for the wonderful editing job he's going to do. And we will speak to you all very soon. And be safe. Keep the shiny side up.
Okay. And you keep the rotors up.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Back to work tomorrow. And the weather's looking slightly improved. We're having poo at the moment. But hey, it's autumn in Britain. What do you expect?
There you go.
All right,
Martin.
Good night, everybody.
See you later.
Ta-da.
Is Jim ahead of Jules?
He's ahead of both of us now.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, yes. And they're both holding their, keeping their powder dry about changing. Because if Jim manages to change to exactly the team I change to or the one that Jules changes to, we can't catch him. But I don't want him to think about that. And hopefully... Yeah, no, it's all right. He won't hear this. This will be edited out. Because Jules will hear that as well, so he won't want it.